Walt Disney here with us this morning. Christine, how are you?
Great. Pleasure to be here.
No, we're glad you're here. Thank you for coming. So maybe I just want to maybe start by just sort of recapping what you said on the last call around modest earnings growth in 2016 and talk about some of those potential issues in 17 and then talk a little bit about the potential reacceleration as we move into 18 and beyond.
Sure. Glad to do that. Our business and our company has had a very strong last few years. In fact, when you look back to 2013, our EPS has grown about 20% on a compound basis, yeah. Compound annual basis. So, you know, that kind of performance has really been driven by a few things. One, and we've talked about this consistently, it's been driven by the strength of our brands, a relentless focus on quality and execution, and that's been fueled by investments that we've made in our organic businesses as well as through M&A activity. So before I get to 2018, I do want to reiterate a couple of things that we did call out on our last earnings call regarding 2017. First, we said that that you could expect modest EPS growth this year. Now, that's obviously below our recent trends. And there's a couple of things I want to call out for sort of reasons that are contributing to that. And the first would be cable programming expense. That will be up about 8% this year, due in large part to the first year of our new MBA contract. And that'll add about $600 million of programming expense. You'll see that starting in the first quarter, but ramping through the MBA season with the most significant impact being in the third quarter, when we'll be in the heart of the NBA playoffs. Second is the comparability that we'll have with our studio business. I think those of you who followed us know that our 2016 studio performance was pretty phenomenal, and that was driven in large part by the tremendous success of Episode 7 of Star Wars, The Force Awakens. And even though 17, we're very bullish on our pipeline for 17, and in fact we had three movies that have released so far this year, which will be in our first quarter, Doctor Strange, Moana, and Rogue One. That's still going to be a tough comparison to 2016 because the output number of films that we have is only 7 compared to 12 feature films last year. So it's that comparability factor. We're just, once again, very excited about that 2017 pipeline for the studio, but tough comparison. And lastly, I just want to call out, we made a comment about our consumer products business. That, too, is going to have tough comparability to 2016. And we said on the call that you could expect to see first quarter down year over year by more than 20%. And once again, it's that comparability factor. So turning to 18, we really are very encouraged by what we see in our businesses looking forward to 18. And a couple of things really give us confidence in that. And the first is, once again, cable. The programming expenses will be much more normalized in 2018 with that first year of the MBA contract behind us. We'll also have the studio output, once again, going up to a more normalized level. Once again, 7 films in 17 will go up to 11 in 18. And of the 11, we're really excited about having 4 Marvel films, 2 Star Wars films, and 3 animated films. And last but not least, we're also excited about our parks business. We expect to see continued growth in our domestic operations, and we'll have 1 full year of Shanghai operations behind us, and we'll grow upon that. So all in all, from where we sit today, we feel really good about 2018, but obviously there's a lot of work to be done between now and then, and of course, execution is going to be the key.
Okay, that's a very helpful summary. When I think back to Disney, at least over the last, I would say, 10 years, there has been M&A, but it's been, you know, small or modest in terms of its scope, right? I'm thinking of Pixar or Marvel or Lucas or Maker. But for some reason, the street sort of has this narrative that's out there that you're going to pursue large-scale M&A. This is the year of transformational M&A for Disney. I know you don't want to talk about specific transactions, but I mean, does that strike you as a cogent narrative? Is there something going on inside Disney that says, yes, we have to do transformational M&A? Or do you think the buy side is staring in their navel for a bit too long and trying to come up with narratives?
Well, Jason, I think the best way to answer that is I, too, have heard that narrative. Okay. But nothing has changed in our approach to M&A. We feel very good about our portfolio of businesses, and our M&A strategy is still a part of our overall growth strategy. And if I can take a step back for a moment, when Bob Iger became CEO, he set forth a pretty straightforward three-pronged strategy that we still use today. And that is, first, that we will invest in and create high-quality branded content. We will be leveraging technology. And we can leverage technology to create content, to enhance experiences, or to improve access to our content. And also, it was also a priority of ours to focus on growing our businesses outside of the U.S. So none of that has changed. Our approach to capital allocation has also not changed. And there's a couple of things that I think are worthy of mention here. The first and foremost is investing in our businesses. And these can be through new initiatives or through existing businesses. A couple of things to mention, parks. We invest in our business domestically as well as internationally. And I think many of you know that we had a great opening of a park that was a multi-year project to completion of Shanghai this past June. And I know we'll talk about that a little bit later. We also invest in film and TV production, and that's across all of our studios. And another thing we invest in is long-term sports rights. Mm-hmm. The other component of capital allocation I want to mention is doing strategic acquisitions. And three that I'd like to call out as being, you know, kind of the tent poles of our acquisition strategy have been Pixar, Marvel, and Lucas. And once again, that is a consistent strategy, has not changed. And lastly, I'd say that the approach that we take to M&A is a very robust one. And we put our any idea, there's a funnel that our head of strategy, Kevin Mayer, uses. It goes through a very rigorous screening process, and it also goes through a very, very thorough evaluation process. And at the end of it all, we're going to do transactions that we believe that are going to create long-term sustainable shareholder value.
Okay. Last year, you did acquire a stake in BAMTech. This year, Hulu is poised to launch its linear service, we heard yesterday. You've mentioned, I think it was on the last earnings call, I think it was when you announced BAMTech, so 2Q, that you're going to do niche ESPN content direct to the consumer over the internet. And I just wondered, is there an overarching strategy that undergirds these particular tactics, or is there not? Are these just sort of tactical opportunities that you see out there, but there is no grand unified strategy behind it?
Well, I think the overarching thing is the environment is changing, and the consumer is changing how they want to consume content. And we've been at the forefront of addressing that change and embracing technology. Bob Iger's been at the forefront of this for many, many years. And in fact, when you look at our company, he led us to be the first company to put our TV content on iTunes. And also, ESPN was the first company to have a live linear stream. So these investments that we've made in BAMTech and in Hulu, they're consistent with an overall strategy, embracing new technologies, leveraging these technologies to bring our content to the consumers.
Okay. You've spoken in the past about the importance of controlling the user interface. Mm-hmm. Why is that so important to you?
Well, we have talked about that, and it is important because we think there's three key elements that are essential to creating a really good consumer experience, especially with video. And that's pretty simply high-quality content, mobility, and user interface. And when we look at high-quality content, we feel really good about the position we're in and the portfolio we have. And that goes across the spectrum of Disney, ESPN, Pixar, Marvel, Lucas properties. I mean, we feel like we have a really good hand to play with the content side. Mobility is something that we know is in the hands of the consumer. The consumer is now the one determining when, how, and where they're going to access their content, and they're also going to choose what platform they're going to use, what service they want to use, what device they want to use. So that mobility is really a key component. And last is the user interface. And to put simply, user interface, it can always be improved, but the three things that we think are essential there, it's got to be easy. It's got to be easy to use, easy to navigate, and easy to find content. So when we look at that, once again, why is the user interface important to Disney? It's because it's important to the consumer. And we approach strategies like this as the consumer is at the core of everything we do. So we know that technology has empowered the consumer. It has given them a lot more power on what they do, how they do it. And technology's also allowed us to have better customization and more personalization in our products.
When we think about it, you guys focus on the user interface, is that sort of through the Hulu mechanism, and you showed a UI yesterday through Hulu, or is it something that transcends that, that goes beyond that?
Well, I think Hulu's not the only platform. There's several new services out there, and they're meeting with what seems to be very good demand initially, and we hope that demand continues. And we believe that with our kind of content, that any new digital MVPD, when they look at what they want to provide to their consumers, Disney content is going to be high on the list, if not the top of the list, because our content is compelling, it is broadly appealing, it's differentiated, and consumers want it. So we think that the user interface is one where Hulu has one that you saw yesterday, many of you saw yesterday, but there's others that have new products in the marketplace, and we think that there'll be continued improvement.
Okay. We've suggested, and maybe incorrectly, that once you have some semblance of direct-to-consumer video delivery, that there may be an opportunity to do some sort of ESPN premium service. And the reason I say that is when you look at what Sky has done with some of their sports content, or what Comcast did with the Olympics, sort of, at least for me, the light bulb went on that you can actually create a much more interesting experience that's a bit more interactive, that might allow you to capture more value from the consumers for the narrow subset that's a true sports enthusiast. Do you think that's a crazy notion, or is that sort of part and parcel with a potential way to monetize an enhanced user interface?
It's not a crazy notion, but I would say that we're fortunate to have very strong brands and cable networks. So we have a lot of flexibility in where we choose and put our content, and we believe that services are going to want our content. We made the investment in BAM, and when we made it, we said that there would be an ESPN-branded direct-to-consumer offering. And that offering, we expect to have it launched in 2017. And right now, it's premature to talk about anything specific around that. But suffice it to say that is not a substitute for ESPN linear networks. It is a complement to what we do on our linear networks. Without getting into specifics, it'll have sports and sporting events that aren't there. And that is totally consistent with ESPN's strategy of super serving sports fans of all kinds.
Okay, that's helpful. So the SEC Network was a really successful launch for Disney. In August of 19, I think, is when you launched the ACC Network. What would you, for those that are out there modeling and doing things a little bit longer term beyond 18, what would be the things that you would say are similar or different from the SEC launch?
Sure. Well, the SEC success was well documented, and we think that the ACC, when it's launched, will also be a successful business for us. Now, a couple things on the on college sports. There are about $200 million sports fans for college sports in the U.S. So that makes a pretty good market for sports viewing of all kinds. And when we look at college sports, we know there's a demand, and we know that the SEC and the ACC are two of the best conferences out there. Now, I just want to give a shout out to a couple of my colleagues because we talk about sports a lot. And John Skipper, who I think many of you know, is our head of ESPN. He went to North Carolina. And Lowell Singer, our head of investor relations, who I know a lot of you know, went to Duke. And they would both say that the ACC is the best conference for basketball. And I think many would agree with that. And also when we look at football, we're in the third year of our college football playoffs. And when you look at the ACC participation in that, the ACC has been in the championships all 3 years. So I'd say they're a force in football as well. Now, when we look at sort of the marketplace, we estimate there are around 3 million active alumni for the ACC in the country. And they tend to be concentrated in some major metropolitan markets like New York City, Boston, D.C., Miami, Atlanta, and even Charlotte. And when those also, I'd mention that about a third of Nielsen households have alumni in the 10-state ACC footprint. So we believe with those kinds of demographics that the ACC network will be met with high demand once it's launched.
Interesting. What about sports ratings? There's been a lot of anxiety over the last, I don't know, 6 months around sports ratings. Do you view that as something that's sort of the beginning of the demise of sports viewership, or is it more a function of the presidential election or bad matchups? Or?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that contribute to any kind of rating in a short-term time frame. So I just like to take a step way back and say that, you know, when you look at our ESPN business, it has been an enduring success for over 3.5 decades. So that is something that, you know, shows that, you know, sports viewing has a lot of viewership, a lot of demand over time. So when we look at some of the specifics around, you know, live sports, we live in a time-shifted environment. We all have to deal with it. Live sports is one of the few things that you really need to see or want to see on a live basis. And, you know, there have been some major sporting events that have set records in the last year, and I'd like to just mention a few of them. One was the NBA Finals that we had on our networks this past June. Phenomenal ratings, great matchups, 7 games, it was awesome. Another one which wasn't on our networks, but I'll mention it because it just once again reinforces the strength of live sports and viewer engagement, was the World Series. I mean, a lot of people, you know, how could you not watch that? And I'd also like to mention our New Year's Six football championship games, or New Year's Six games, and the championship is on Monday, but we've been through 6 of the 7. The ratings for those 6 games are up double digits over a year ago. And I don't know how many avid USC or Penn State fans are out in the audience today, but I would say if you didn't see the Rose Bowl live, either there or on ESPN, you really missed a game for the ages. It was an incredible game. And if you heard about it and watched a replay, it just wasn't as good as watching it live. So that's just another, you know, point I'd like to highlight, that in live sports, you know, when you see them, I mean, they're a really must see. So when you mentioned the NFL, you know, NFL ratings, you know, were well documented in the press that they were challenged, and I think some of the things you mentioned, you know, did play factors. I think we can all agree that we have been through a very, very interesting election season, and that was probably kind of one of a kind when you look at election seasons, you know, in previous falls. And there are also some things that are going to happen with specific matchups or injuries to key players. But I think, you know, those are things that, you know, whether or not they're long-term remains to be seen. But I think, you know, when you look at this particular year, there were a lot of factors that contributed.
Okay. Liberty had an analyst day, I think it was a couple months ago, last year. And Dr. Malone, who sort of has a big following on the buy side, sort of said, you know, Disney's problem is they need to structurally separate ESPN from the rest of the business. And that sort of, you know, that narrative sort of got a little bit of wind in its sails. Is that something that you think is possible or makes sense for Disney to pursue? Or do you still view the totality of all of the Disney assets under one corporation as the right model going forward?
Well, Jason, I think I'd say that everyone is welcome to their opinions. Okay. But we are very pleased with our company assets. They're very strong. Our company asset mix is very strong. And we also are very, very bullish on the future of our company. And I'd also say we don't comment on that kind of speculation.
Okay. I think at least I was surprised. I think a number of investors were also that you said on the last earnings call that you expected Shanghai to achieve break-even EBIT this year versus, I think it was at least $300 million of startup losses. What was it that caused that inflection to occur so quickly? And does it have derivative implications for future investments that you might make in Europe or in Hong Kong for your other parks? In other words, was it a scale-driven inflection that has derivative implications for the other parks that you have?
Sure. Well, I mentioned Shanghai early in the conversation. We did open our park in June, and we could not be happier with the launch of our park in Shanghai. And it is it's set a solid foundation upon which we can grow. And within the first 4 months, we welcomed 4 million guests to the park. Now, I would remind you that those 4 months did include the peak summer travel season. We also have found that consumers and guests at our park are staying longer than we anticipated, and that's also a very good sign of engagement. And we also are seeing more visitation from guests coming from outside of Shanghai, and much more so than we had anticipated. And hotel occupancy is also at very high rates. So when we look at where we're starting from, we feel very, very good about where we are. Now, when we build these parks in locations outside of the U.S., we try to make them as locally relevant as possible. And this park, I would say, I think we did an incredibly thorough assessment of the sensibilities and what the Chinese market wanted. And we like to refer to that park as authentically Disney and distinctly Chinese. And I think some in the audience may have already visited the park. And I think you'd agree that when you're there, you know you're at a Disney park, but you also know you're in China. So where we are today on that park, there'll always be things that we can tweak around the edges. What you want to get right when you go into a new market is understanding, you know, their travel patterns, making sure you understand school vacations and weekends and just some of the things that are going to be more specific to a local market. And we'll tweak those around the edges. And some things will be kind of discreet as food offerings. And we know, and I know this was well reported in the press, you know, we found that they like turkey legs and corn dogs quite a bit, especially at the opening of the park. And we'll also tweak, you know, merchandise offerings. So, you know, getting it right takes a little bit of time. So we're very bullish on the long-term future of that park. But we also believe that where we are today, that we will be at or near break even.
Okay.
Now, as it relates to, I just want to make a couple of comments on the other two parks that you mentioned internationally. Disneyland Paris has had some real challenges. And part of it was that park started out with a very onerous capital structure. And we've taken measures over the years to simplify the capital structure, and we continue to do that. Also, our park is in Paris, and I think we all know that there have been some issues specific to Paris that have affected tourism, and they've also affected tourism throughout Europe, in France in particular. So those things all impact, the desire to go to a park. I'd also say that we have made some investments recently to improve the guest experience because Disneyland Paris is actually celebrating its 25th anniversary that'll launch this coming spring. And we're feeling good about that, and, you know, we'll see how it goes.
Okay.
Hong Kong was actually too small at the beginning. And we expanded that park in 2011, 12, and 13. And just next week, we're opening our first Marvel-themed attraction in a theme park. It's called the Iron Man Experience. And we think that is going to drive demand, significant demand, as Marvel characters resonate really, really well in that market.
Interesting.
And we also have a new hotel opening in Hong Kong this coming in the later in the year. It's a 750-room hotel. So Hong Kong's had some macro issues over the last few years, but we build these parks for the long term, and we are very bullish on the Hong Kong market.
Okay, that's very helpful. This summer at Disney World, you're opening Avatar.
Yes.
How should investors think about that? Is that just one of those sort of normal maintenance refreshes, or would you put this in a different category in terms of its likely financial impact, in terms of what investors will see?
Well, that's a great question, because it's a lot more than a refresh. Avatar will be, it's called Pandora, the World of Avatar, and it is a 10-acre land inside of Disney's Animal Kingdom. It's the first major expansion we've had inside of Animal Kingdom, and it will continue to build out that park to be a full-day experience. It will be a fully immersive land. It will have not only attractions, dining, retail, entertainment, but you'll feel like you are in the world of Avatar when you're there. The analogy that I'd make with that is when we opened Cars Land in 2012, it really transformed Disney California Adventure. And what we saw there was we had an immediate uplift in attendance. And it rebalanced the mix between our park with Disneyland, the Disneyland Resort, there's a Disneyland Park, and the Disney California Adventure Park. And that even now, 5 years later, we're still seeing a very good balance between those parks, because that lift, it was immediate, but it's also been sustainable.
That's interesting. Last year, you began construction in Orlando for a new Toy Story attraction. And in Orlando and California, you're working on these big Star Wars attractions. Can you discuss these projects as well?
Anything you want to share? I can discuss them a little bit.
Okay.
Let's talk about Star Wars first. Those are two significant projects. We have one in Orlando that'll be at Disney Hollywood Studio, and we have one in Anaheim that will be in the Disneyland Park, the Magic Kingdom Park. They're both 14-acre lands. Once again, fully immersive experiences. They'll have two primary attractions that I just would mention for the Star Wars fans out there. The first is one where you can take the controls of the Millennium Falcon and go on your own customized mission. That's kind of cool. And the other is another immersive experience where you'll be in the middle of a battle between the Resistance and the First Order. Also very cool. So there'll also be plenty of dining, retail, entertainment, and once again, a fully immersive experience. We haven't announced the opening date. These are very long-term. These are massive projects. They take years to complete. So stay tuned on that. Toy Story Land is also going to be in Disney Hollywood Studios down in Orlando. That's an 11-acre land, once again. We're big into lands, as you can see. And that's also an immersive experience. But it's going to be an immersive experience for Toyland. It puts you in Andy's backyard. So it's just because of the nature of the content of the IP, it'll skew more towards families with younger children, but also something we're really looking forward to. So with both Star Wars and Toy Story down in Orlando in Hollywood Studios, that'll really transform that park.
I was chatting with the CEO of Cedar Fair the other day, and he said one of the only investments that he's seen in a theme park where the investment was made and it sort of created a new permanent plateau was Universal's Harry Potter upgrade down in Orlando. Have you seen other, I guess you would characterize Cars, mm-hmm. land out on the West Coast as sort of a permanent plateau. Is that sort of what the objective is with a lot of these, 10-acre, 11-acre upgrades, is seeking a new permanent plateau? Is that?
Well, I think if we can look back at Cars, the reaction to opening Cars was an immediate uplift, and it was sustainable. It is, once again, those are the kind of step function changes you can see in parks like this. So, you know, I'm not going to predict what will happen, but I think when you look at the fan bases that we have for all of these IP, whether it's, you know, Star Wars or Toy Story, both powerful, powerful IP, as well as Avatar.
That's interesting. Do we have any questions for Christine? If you do have a question, we can get you a microphone. There's one up in the front.
Hi. I had a couple of questions from a European perspective, actually. We've seen a couple of examples of Disney coming in and sort of testing the water with its own direct-to-consumer exposure. It disintermediated one of the RTL channels and has gone direct-to-consumer with a children's channel in Germany, and then there's the Disney Life experiment in the UK. Can you just talk about direct-to-consumer outside of the US and whether those are just simple trials for what you're planning to do here, or is there a move to be more proactive as an actual channel in some of those European markets?
Sure. I think you're referring to Disney Life, which was launched in the UK a little over a year ago. That was, it still is a product that we have in the UK. It has Disney content that's available. It's a subscription service, direct to consumer. I think, once again, this is very consistent with the way we are, where we experiment, we try things, our strategy will evolve, and it's just another thing that we've done. And we did it in a market where we could really test various elements, and, you know, look at the technology, look at the engagement, look at how the consumers were using it. And it's just consistent with us. You know, there's not one path that we're taking. I think we're trying a lot of different things, and once again, really trying to assess how the consumer wants to engage with our content most fully.
Interesting. About 5 years ago, you added two new cruise ships to your overall portfolio with Dream and Fantasy, and I think it's right that in another 5 years, you're going to add two more cruise ships. Is the derivative implication from that that every time you build one of these, the financial returns are successful and you just add another one in the portfolio? And is there a limit to how much demand there is for sort of a Disney-branded cruise? I mean, I know you have a good reputation, you get good, better than industry average pricing in terms of cabin prices. But I would infer that all signals are positive from all your past investments in this segment.
Yeah, they certainly are. We launched, we had a fleet of two. We doubled it to four. We put two new ships into commission in 2011 and 2012. They were both profitable. The first quarter they were in operations, which is pretty phenomenal. We expect the two new ships that we're building to also be very profitable. The returns on the last two ships when we put them into operation, we're getting mid-teens ROIs in that. And we expect the two incremental ships to have similar returns. And as you mentioned, Jason, we have the Family Cruise product. It has a lot of demand. We have a high guest satisfaction, a lot of repeat visitation, a lot of multi-generational families go on these cruises. But we also have premium pricing and very high occupancy and load factors on the ships. So it's a product that we think is going to continue to be successful. And in fact, in 2016, we set records for both revenue and operating income in that business.
Interesting. Maybe we can go to the first question, make it a bit interactive. You should all have the clickers on your table. So let's just see if we go to the first.
Can I play along too?
Yeah, you can play along. There's a clicker right there, absolutely. So Disney will pursue large-scale M&A this year. True or false? I missed that. I'm sitting there looking at my notes. I missed which one you clicked. Are you going to share what you're not going to? Wow, that's shocking. So 41% said true, 59% said false. That's a much higher percentage of true than I would have thought. Okay, so we're right. So the market is focused on this. Let's go to the next one. So if Disney's earnings growth normalizes in fiscal 18, I expect mid to high single-digit growth, double-digit growth, or mid-teens growth.
Gotta hide.
She's hiding it. We give you 1,000 waiting points. So.
Okay,
so 32% mid to high single, 53% double digit, and only 15% mid-teens growth. All right, we'll go to the last question. The single most important factor that prevents me from buying Disney stock is, one, it's unclear how management navigates changes in the pay TV ecosystem, given ESPN's fixed costs. Two, I expect the strong string of hit movies to come to an end. Three, the theme park trends have to roll over. Or four, I need to know who the next CEO is before I can invest.
I'm not playing on this one. I'm long Disney stock.
Wow, 84%. Wow. Unclear how Disney navigates the changes in the pay TV ecosystem. Only 2% were concerned about the movie hits coming to an end. None expect the theme park to roll over, and only 15% need to know who the CEO is. Wow, that's interesting.
It is interesting.
That's probably the most skewed result we've had all the questions we've asked. Yeah. So what about Rogue One? Can you tell me about Rogue One? I know that the reviews were really bad. I have to tell you a funny story. I went
bad.
I think they were bad. I went to see it with my son, and I told him, I said, look, I just want to warn you. Some of the reviews were pretty bad for this movie, and he said, I still want to go see it. And right after it was done, you know, the lights came on, and he's only 9. He looked over to me and said, I don't know why the reviews were bad. That was a really good movie. So he enjoyed it. But the results are pretty good, right?
The results are very good. So Rogue One, we are very excited about. We had an opening weekend with Global Box, just a little under $300 million. Currently, the Global Box is a little over $825 million, with $450 million of that being domestic. And most of the major markets are open, with one, which I want to call out and mention, tomorrow, which I think is today over there, is in China. Hmm. And we're very excited about the opening of Rogue One in China.
Interesting. So here, this is maybe an unfair question, but when I think back to the Disney sort of pre-Pixar Marvel Lucas, you know, I wouldn't say that I sort of thought of you as a fantastic studio or someone that never had sort of a unsuccessful film. It was just a normal studio, hits and misses. And then post these acquisitions, it's just everything has changed, right? Like all the movies come out, they're great movies, the box office results are consistently strong. What is it that's happening sort of behind the scenes that is allowing you to make great movies? I mean, obviously IP is an element of that, but that's a necessary but not sufficient condition to make a great movie. So what's happening?
That's a great question. So I would say we have a great track record, but no studio is immune to a miss. This is a creative business. But what we have is, we have two elements that really differentiate us in our studio business. One, as you mentioned, is great IP, and the other is a sound strategy. And we talk about our IP acquisitions because they've been so powerful and been so successful for us. But it was when we did Pixar, Marvel, and Lucas. Since those acquisitions, we've released 32 films. And the average box office of those 32 films is almost $800 million.
Wow.
And I say that very deliberately because that is a pretty stunning number. So one of the things when we bought those studios, it wasn't just about buying IP. It was also about buying talent and management. And when we bought Pixar, Bob Iger was very, very adamant that Pixar had a way of doing business and we were going to keep it intact. Mm-hmm. And we did. So that has worked out. That wasn't by, it wasn't a mistake or by luck. He very much wanted to keep their creative brain trust intact, their processes, what I call their secret sauce. Some people may call it their special DNA. But we kept it intact. And they also helped transform our Disney animation business as well. So they kind of oversee all of our animation. But we also took that and applied that same methodology and kind of management practice when we bought Marvel and Lucas. So when you look at those, we have studios within our studios, and it's really enabled them to make the kind of movie that is really true to their genre and true to their, you know, kind of franchise. So that's been very, very important.
Okay, that's helpful. Any other questions for Christine? All right, I want to ask you one last question, then we'll let you go. You mentioned earlier that as we go out to 2018, the number of films that you're going to be releasing will be more than 2017. Mm-hmm. I think it was 7 and 11. What are the films that you're most excited about internally at Disney when you go out to fiscal 18?
Well, before I get to 18, yeah. I just want to mention 17. Sure. And you know, we talked about the three we've already released, Doctor Strange, Moana, and Rogue One. But in our second quarter, we have one movie coming out, Beauty and the Beast. And Beauty and the Beast broke records for 24-hour viewing of trailers when the first and second trailers hit. So there's a lot of demand, anticipation and demand for Beauty and the Beast. And then we have three movies coming out in our third quarter. We have Guardians of the Galaxy 2. I'm very excited about that, and I'm looking forward to the music. We have Pirates 5. And we have Cars 3. And Cars 3 will also, we anticipate having a strong merchandise business as we have, that's an evergreen kind of consumer products business for us. So that's 17. And when we look forward to 18, I think, you know, one of the big ones that we're looking forward to is Episode 8. That'll come out a year next Christmas. And we also have, before that, we have four Marvel movies, as I mentioned. And the first one is Thor, Ragnarok. And we also have a Pixar movie, Coco, that's coming. And then we have the others that'll, you know, cycle through the year. So I would say we couldn't be more excited about 2018, but we're looking at 2017 and feeling really, really good about that studio slate as well.
That's fantastic. Well, Christine, thank you very much for the time. This has been great.
Thank you, Jason.
Yeah, thank you.